forth to show up. The trucks would all stay at the small, and at night, any mechanical needs, Ameren sent several mechanics out there. They would take care of any mechanical needs. They would fuel the trucks up, make sure they were ready to go the next day. Working-wise, we spent a lot of time. We did some in Trenton. We did a little bit in Princeton. We were in East Brunswick and New Brunswick and a town called Wachung. And they were all west to west central part of New Jersey.
Is there any way to call a day typical after you've done this for a couple of days? I assume a lot of power lines wrapped around trees and that sort of thing?
A lot of lines were broke. A lot of lines just came off the poles. Maybe you would have a tree fall down, and it might take 10 or 15 spans of wire, just knock the wire off the insulator, and it would be laying on the ground. Occasionally it would break, and then you'd have to sleeve the wire together to get it back going. It was just kind of like a bad windstorm. You might go down one or two blocks, and they would have power, or there didn't look like there was any damage. And you might go down the next couple blocks, and you know, you might have four or five poles broke and several spans of wire broke. There was no continuity to it.
And I know one of the main parts of your focus in the interview with the News Gazette was talking about drivers around there. Can you talk a bit about interaction with some citizens and some positive feedback?
The drivers... That's just the way they drive out there. I have a brother-in-law that was born and raised in New Jersey who now lives in Pennsylvania. He even made comments about the drivers. The people were the most generous, nicest, sharing people. Every day it seemed like somebody would bring us a jug of Joe, which is a big thing out there, like a gallon cardboard box of coffee. They'd bring us water. They'd bring us pop. They'd bring us cookies, donuts, and people were just very compassionate out there. They were glad to see us. There was a few grumpy ones, and I don't really know how I would react after 2 weeks with no lights. I'd probably start getting a little grumpy, too.
And how long were your days?
We'd start at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we'd quit about 10 o'clock at night.
Anything else you want to add, something that you weren't expecting to come away with from there?
Like I said, the generosity of the people just really caught me off guard, which was a pleasant thing. They were very friendly. My guys were out there, the 12 guys that went out from Champaign, Paxton, and Danville. The story that just impressed me with these guys was the fact that we were working in East Brunswick, and that's where the state headquarters for the Red Cross was for New Jersey. The guys passed the hat and took up a collection and donated $300 to the New Jersey Red Cross, which to me that was amazing.
Jeff Bossert spoke with Ameren Supervisor Dan Mushrush, who led a crew of utility linemen from the Champaign area to northern New Jersey in relief of Superstorm Sandy and the nor'easter a few days later. He's been with Ameren for 35 years. World AIDS Day is tomorrow. A grassroots movement started in 1988. The day is a rallying cry for people to unite in the fight against HIV. But lately, one central Illinois woman feels the HIV battle has slipped from the national health radar, and she wants to do something about it. Illinois Public Radio's Laura Kennedy has more.
In the kitchen of Kat Griffith's home in rural Metamora, a pan of recently roasted pumpkin seeds sits on the stove. Bottles of nutritional supplements nestle in the corner of the counter. And on the kitchen table is a musical birthday card. Sitting in the living room, her boxer dog Apollo at her right, Kat Griffith grins and accepts the greetings of the day. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Can I ask which one it is?
29 again.
Actually, Griffith fesses up to 42. It's a milestone she was warned she'd never reach. At her left on the sofa is a pile of medicine bottles.
So there's one I take, two, three, four, five.
As she counts up the medications she must take, Griffith reflects on another milestone. The day she learned she was HIV positive. It was 1992.
May 26th, 2:15 in the afternoon.
Griffith was 21 years old and attending college in Colorado.
To say it was traumatic would be an understatement.
Given 2 years to live, Griffith quit school 1 week before finals and flew to Tennessee to be with her ailing boyfriend, the one who had infected her. On the journey, Griffith read a book she says completely changed her outlook. Love, Medicine, and Miracles by Dr. Bernie Siegel touts the philosophy of healing the life rather than the disease.
I have always been a head-on person. The way that I thought about life and this disease and all of those things really was impacted by that book.
Griffith went back to college and today is a social work graduate student at Illinois State University. She improved her diet, exercised, and took up meditation. Griffith also takes her HIV drug cocktail. Most recently, true to her head-on fashion, she's become an HIV activist. She attended the International Conference on AIDS in Washington, D.C., and the U.S. Conference on AIDS in Las Vegas this past summer. Griffith says she's still uncomfortable speaking publicly about her fight, but feels it has to be done to fill the silence that has fallen around HIV in this country.
Nobody's talking about it anymore.
So many people were dying before. It was like a battlefield.
Michael McGinn heads up the Peoria-based group Central Illinois Friends of People with AIDS. He says learning how to fight HIV kept it in the headlines in the 80s and 90s.
There were no antiretroviral therapy regimens. They didn't know how to combat it.
McGinn says when the drug cocktails came along, the disease was pushed off the front page. Dr. Donna McCree with the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta agrees and says medical advances have created a false sense of security in the public's mind. She says effective treatments have led to the belief that HIV is not a major health threat anymore.
Once we saw the advent of the effective treatments and people being tested and linked to care, then there was sort of a decrease in having HIV discussions right out at the forefront.
But that's not all. McCree says there's still a significant amount of stigma associated with HIV/AIDS, even after 3 decades of grappling with the disease.
That can sort of keep individuals from talking about it. That's one of the things we want to address, that is taking aim at the apathy and at the stigma that sort of helped fuel HIV in this country.
I am one of more than a million people living with HIV in the U.S.
The CDC is taking aim with the launch of a new campaign, Let's Stop HIV Together, which focuses on getting HIV back on the radar of all Americans. Michael McGinn, with the Central Illinois Friends of People with AIDS, says activism can break down the walls of stigma and that people like Kat Griffith can bring a strong voice to the discussion. Griffith acknowledges that she makes people squirm by talking about HIV because they realize just how vulnerable they are to the disease.
Anytime, usually, when you get the how did you get it question, what's behind that is how can I differentiate myself from you? And how can I see myself as different from you so that I know that I can still keep doing what I'm doing and not have to worry?
Griffith knows the discrimination too well. She has advanced kidney failure and is currently on a transplant list.
Just in the last couple of days, I've heard a couple of different people say, why would you give a kidney to her? She's going to be dead anyway. And that's just kind of the general kind of thought. And it's also prevalent in the medical profession as well. There's doctors that think that.
According to the CDC, there are 1.1 million Americans living with HIV. 1 in 5 are unaware they're infected. 50,000 people are newly infected every year. Donna McCree from the CDC says there needs to be an open discussion of HIV, as with other chronic diseases.
We want to get that conversation back out there and keep it out there so we can have an impact on what's going on.
Michael McGinn from Friends of People with AIDS says activism from Kat Griffith and others can help spur interest in new research and get pharmaceutical companies to seek a cure.
They're doing wonderful work in trying to really work with bone marrow and affecting the cell's regenerative process of not regenerating the disease and new cell work. So I think it's very encouraging.
Griffith tries to remain positive, using social media as a part of her activism and education about HIV. But she feels more people need to come out as HIV positive and become activists. Meanwhile, Griffith refuses to give in and fights on against the disease and its stigma.
In a lot of cases, people still see me as dying, and here I am 21 years later, still not doing it.
Griffith hopes a cure will eventually put her out of the activism business. In the meantime, she's speaking at the Methodist Medical Center in Peoria at an event that marks World AIDS Day. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The fight against AIDS was the topic on Thursday's Focus. You can hear that show anytime at will.illinois.edu. The Greater Community AIDS Project will hold a candlelight vigil in Champaign's Westside Park tomorrow at 4:30 as part of World AIDS Day events. Community members are encouraged to come and light a candle in commemoration of those who have been lost and those who are still fighting HIV and AIDS.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, truffles, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Also, find specialty ingredients like saffron, smoked paprika, truffle salt, grain of paradise, and more. World Harvest Foods, 6th and University in Champaign.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 30th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, "A successful book is not made of what is in it, but of what is left out of it." Mark Twain, born Samuel Clemens, Florida, Missouri, 1835. His first book was a collection of short stories called The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, came out in 1867. Did not sell many copies, but it made his reputation. And 2 years later, Mark Twain published The Innocents Abroad, his humorous book about traveling to Europe with other American tourists, which was a big bestseller. In fact, it was the best-selling of all Mark Twain's books during his own lifetime. Over the next 25 years, he published Tom Sawyer, Life on the Mississippi, and in 1884, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, founded his own publishing company, published the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant, which was hugely successful. And then, as most people know, he invested a huge amount of money in the automatic typesetting machine called the Page Compositor, which turned out to be an abysmal failure. He was in financial trouble. His book, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, did not sell very well. He took his family to Europe, wrote Pudd'nhead Wilson, 1894. It did not sell well either, and so he went on a worldwide lecture tour to earn money. In 1896, his daughter Susie died at the age of 24 from spinal meningitis. And after that, Mark Twain sank into depression. His wife, Olivia, died in 1904. And a year later, on this day in 1905, Mark Twain turned 70, and he had a big party at Delmonico's restaurant in New York City. Willa Cather came, Andrew Carnegie. There was a 40-piece orchestra, and Mark Twain got up and gave a speech. He said his 70th birthday was far superior to his first. He said, "I remember the first very well. Everything was so crude, unaesthetic, primeval. I hadn't any hair. I hadn't any teeth. I hadn't any clothes." Secret of long life, he said, was to smoke only when awake and to avoid exercise at all costs. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston entitled Vertical.